Abigail, just a few announcements. Children are welcome in this space. We love children. We want them to be around, but we know that sometimes parents like to be free from their children for a little bit. And if you need childcare, right after these announcements, you can meet me back here in this corner, and I'll help your children get over to childcare for you. Also, we do have sign language interpretation for our folks who are deaf or hard of hearing, and there's a reserve section down here in the front for folks in that community. And also tonight, remember that this is maybe not your regular night of work, as Reverend Erica has told us. And these cell phones that you took out, we value you taking them out repeatedly, over and over and over again while we're here tonight, taking pictures, telling folks what's going on, spreading the story and the message of this campaign and the people who will testify tonight.
Amen. And so we also want to let you know that out in the vestibule, there are books being sold tonight. Reverend Dr. William J. Barber's book, Third Reconstruction. How many of you have that? All right. And for those of you who don't, there's an opportunity to purchase it there. And also Reverend Dr. Leah Steele Harris's book, Always With Us, What Jesus Really Said About the Poor. So that's a key book. I ask for you all to read it as we're doing this Poor People's Campaign. We need to know what the truth is about what is said about the poor and dispossessed. So make sure you check out the table in the back. So we're going to get started. We hope that all of you will sit back, as we say in my church, take your shoes off. Take your hair off if you need to, if you get a little too hot. And let us come together and celebrate tonight for a Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. Don't lose no energy. Come on, D.C. Come on, Maryland. Come on, Virginia. They're live streaming all over the nation tonight. Let it be known that we will not be silent anymore. So if you're ready to get started, stand up with me. Join us as we bring
standing. Those of you who at some point need to sit down, I understand, but this is a standing event right here, because we're going to sing together. And I have a motto that has kind of grown on folks, and I say that we stand together because we stand together. Is that okay? And so the first order of business is to thank the choirs for coming together. So we have two pieces of business that we got to take care of. The first is, if you're looking up in this choir and you just have this burning desire to sing with us, or you look up here and you say, I'm not quite represented, because the movement is so diverse, it's so open, right? So if you want to just ease out, ask somebody to excuse you, you've got business in the choir stand, okay? The second order of business probably should have come first, but we're going to do this, and know that I love you. I do it everywhere, so I'm not just picking on you. How many people in here sing alto, please? How many people in here sing tenor? Soprano, bass, and baritone. How many people in here have no clue? Now, I want you to raise two hands. Thank you, Ross, for being... She always raises her hand, but somehow gets drawn into the music. So, those of you who raise your hands that you don't know where you are, and you're standing next to somebody who knows, look at them and make friends with them. And this piece of advice has gone from East Coast to West, North to South, because I promise you, if you help somebody sing their note tonight, make them sign a promissory note to give it back the way they got it. It's not going to happen that way, but it's okay. So, can we sing together now? And I'm hoping I'm seeing some people moving, coming up to the choir stand. We really do want you to come. All right? So I'm going to try this mic. And the first song that we're going to do, now we're reaching back and we're kind of inviting the ancestors in. And I want to say this, and I stand on it, and it's not always popular. I hear some people saying this is not your grandmother's movement. So we need to do away with the songs. I want you to know that if it wasn't for my grandmother's movement, if it wasn't for the songs my grandmama sang, if it wasn't for the way my grandmama fought, we wouldn't know how to fight. So in essence, this is my grandmother's movement. And I want when my grandson starts to fight to say, this is my grandmother's movement, right? So let's sing some of our grandmother's songs. Now the first song we're going to do together is called Everybody's Got a Right to Live. And it was written by Jimmy Collier, who was a part of the original Poor People's Campaign, 68. And he sang this song, and we're using this all across the country. We want you to get familiar with this song and to sing it as often as possible. And there is even a competition going on for you to upload yourselves singing this song. All of you I don't knows, we love you. Mail your song in, it's okay. All right, so the song goes, Everybody's Got a Right to Live. Give it up for the band. Our sister here on the keys, give it up, give it up. Okay, I'm gonna sing this one time, and then there's a part in here that you're really gonna have to have your mind made up to sing it. You'll know it when you get there. It goes, Everybody's got a right to live. Everybody's got a right to live. And before this campaign fails, we'll all go down to jail. Everybody's got a right to... Are we ready? Let's go. Transparent moment, I suppose. I woke up this morning with my mind
stayed on Freedom. Now, stuff happened between that time and now, but at least I woke up with my mind, stayed on Freedom, and I got it back on Freedom. And where I stand, my mind is stayed on Freedom. Can we do that one? Yeah. like if you would just allow me to go back to the wood church. Wood floors, wood stove, and a whole lot of mothers in the corner yelling, "Sing, baby," during testimony service. And the song would go like, "Come on, come on, come on." They holler and we have to holler back, "Don't you want to go? Come on, come on, come on. Come on, come on, come on." And then all together we would say, "Yes, I want to go." Okay, choir rehearsal. Here we go. Come on, come on, come on. Don't you want to go? Come on, come on, come on. Don't you come on, come on, come on. Oh, yes, I want to go. That was choir rehearsal. Don't get too happy. Don't get too happy. That was choir rehearsal. All right? So we're going to take it up a little bit. I know the musicians are, I love y'all. Here we go. Come on, come on, come on. Don't you want to go?
Thank you.
concert on the road, y'all. Pack your bags. I don't see a timekeeper, but I think we're right there. Maybe, perhaps. So let's go out on one more. Is that okay? Y'all got the energy for one more? All right. Here we go.
We shall not be moved.
National co-chairs of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. It is an honor to be with you all this evening. Good evening, Washington, D.C. We want to be welcomed by some of the folks that have been doing organizing here in D.C. from the D.C. Coordinating Committee as well as from Shiloh Baptist Church. So I invite Reverend Terrence Mayo and Reverend George Mensah to come offer a welcome.
Seven thousand four hundred and seventy-three residents in D.C. were counted as homeless in 2017. 7,473. Mothers, fathers, daughters, sons, nieces, nephews, neighbors, friends. They were students attending DCPS, but not knowing where they were going when they left school. The adults working two jobs, 14-hour days, but still don't make enough to afford housing. They are adults working full-time jobs, taking care of their children, going to complete GEDs, but passing every day vacant buildings that used to be housing. They are you, they are me, they are all of us here tonight. But as we know, these numbers don't tell the entire story of poverty and homelessness in the city. As the median income continues to rise in certain wards in D.C., it continues to decline in others. The disparity we see continues to widen day by day. We hear the cries of families having to decide between transportation or food that evening. We feel the tension of residents no longer feeling welcome in their own communities that they lived in for centuries. Tonight, we name the sins of poverty. We name the sin of systematic racism. We name the sin of war economy. We name the sin of ecological devastation. We name the sins of America. Tonight, we name those 7,473 and those that were not counted. Tonight, we welcome you here today to lift up the voices of the poor and dispossessed in this nation and particularly in this city. Tonight, we call for a moral revolution of values to set us back on the path to equality of all people. Tonight, we welcome you here today to resist the systems that have been put in place to keep us marginalized, oppressed, and divided. Tonight, we resist separation of classes. Tonight, we resist racism. Tonight, we resist oppression. Tonight, we resist. Tonight, we welcome you to resist.
Good evening. My name is George Mensah, and I'm a proud son of Africa and call this great nation of ours my home. I am pleased to stand here today to welcome you into this house of worship. To the co-chairs of the Poor People's Campaign, Dr. William Barber and Dr. Liz Thea Harris, my dear brother Dr. Hagler, to all of the organizers, our friends, sympathizers, and well-wishers, we welcome you to Shiloh on behalf of our pastor, the Reverend Dr. Wallace Charles Smith, and the terrific people of this great congregation. I welcome you and thank God for your commitment and dedication to the service of God and God's people. Dr. Barber and Dr. Thea Harris, the mission you have embarked on today is not only important, but essential, because it is our moral and spiritual responsibility responsibility to address the issue of poverty and injustice suffered by many of God's children. It is important and essential because our faith tradition calls us individually as well as collectively to stand in the gap for those who cannot stand for themselves. This great church, organized 154 years ago by 21 free slaves, Shiloh is rich in its tradition of reaching out to those who find themselves on the fringes of life, those who have been marginalized and relegated to certain social status because of inequitable political and social systems. This congregation has always been on the forefront of ministering to the least of these. It has been our long custom to tackle the issues in service to God and to humanity. Our missionary ministry began the Alley Dwelling Movement, serving those who live in shanties in the alleys of our city. We took part in the march in 1963 on Washington and opened Shiloh to the marchers as a place to come and refresh and rest before and after the march. And we supported, hosted Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. when other religious leaders rejected his ideas and denied him access. Shiloh has long been a drum major for social justice. And we are pleased that it is high time that we return to our roots. So, my brothers and sisters, it is only benefiting that the Poor People's Campaign rally is being held here at Shiloh to re-energize the movement that Dr. King started 50 years ago and gave his life for. So I say welcome, welcome, and I pray God's blessings upon our deliberations here today. God bless you.
Thank you so much. We now want to begin with an interfaith clergy reading of the fundamental principles of the campaign. And so I welcome Bishop Allison Abrams, Reverend Abby Janamanchi, and Reverend Amanda Poppy.
We are rooted in a moral analysis based on our deepest religious and constitutional values that demand justice for all. Moral revival is necessary to save the heart and soul of our democracy.
We are committed to lifting and deepening the leadership of those most affected by systemic racism, poverty, the war economy, and ecological devastation, and to building unity across lines of division.
We believe in the dismantling of unjust criminalization systems that exploit poor communities and communities of color, and the transformation of the war economy into a peace economy that values all humanity.
We believe that equal protection under the law is non-negotiable. Amen.
We believe that people should not live in or die from poverty in the richest nation ever to exist, blaming the poor and claiming that the United States does not have an abundance of resources to overcome poverty or false narratives used to perpetuate economic exploitation, exclusion, and deep inequality.
We recognize that the centrality of systemic racism in maintaining economic oppression must be named, detailed, and exposed empirically, morally, and spiritually. Poverty and economic equality cannot be understood apart from a society built on white supremacy.
We aim to shift the distorted moral narrative often promoted by religious extremists in the nation from personal issues like prayer in school, abortion, sexuality, gun rights, property rights, to systemic injustices like how our society treats the poor, those on the margins, the least of these, women, children, workers, immigrants, and the sick. Equality and representation under the law, and the desire for peace, love, and harmony within and among nations.
We will build up the power of people and state-based movements to serve as a vehicle for a powerful moral movement in the country and to transform the political, economic, and moral structures of our society.
We recognize the need to organize at the state and local level. Many of the most regressive policies are being passed at the state level, and these policies will have long and lasting effect, past even executive orders. This movement is not from above, but below.
We will do our work in a nonpartisan way. No elected officials or candidates get the stage or serve on the state organizing committee of the campaign. This is not about left or right, Democrat or Republican, but about right and wrong.
We uphold the need to do a season of sustained nonviolent civil disobedience as a way to break through the tweets and shift the moral narrative. We are demonstrating the power of people coming together across issues and geography and putting our bodies on the line to the issues that are affecting us all.
The campaign and all its participants and endorsers embrace nonviolence. Violent tactics or actions will not be tolerated. These are the fundamental principles of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for more revival. Somebody ought to say amen. Somebody ought to give God the praise for this campaign.
At this time, I want to introduce and welcome Donsha Watkins, who is going to share a spoken word piece with us, as well as after that is going to be a video about the campaign. And so, please welcome Donsha Watkins.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Donsha Watkins, and I am extremely excited to be here, so I'm going to share a spoken word with you all today. Dear Average Joe, the one who constantly says, "What can I do? It's not my issue, so what? That's them." You are powerful. It amuses me how this perpetuated system has you in this isolated prison, Willie Lynch letter division. See, how can I help others when I'm just barely winning? winning. You have got to be kidding. Average Joe, don't you know you are royalty? A leader made in God's image claiming less than you were born to be? The world knows you. Society fears your strength, and they know your knowledge will only liberate those around you, so they politically silence your voice. Well, Joe, I'm just glad I found you, because I have a message for you. In a world full of supermen, you are the Black Panther. They search for immoral truth, but in God, I found the answer, you see. This weekend, so many people went to the movie and idolized Wakanda, never realizing that we are Wakanda, overflowing with every resource we need to fight systematic oppression, the war with economics. We have the resources to stop funding prisons more than we fund college. We are a powerful people. And when one starves, we all starve. The injustice of one ripples to affect a million, and the things you don't stand for now will only affect your children. See, how can you separate yourself from the oppressor if you idly sit by and watch the oppressed? The sins of a man who knows better but never does better will soon catch up with him, because it's easy to say don't drown, but it's another to teach to swim. The Bible says, speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. For the right of all who are destitute, speak up and judge fairly. Defend the rights of the poor and those in need. I'm not trying to preach a lifestyle change. I'm just merely planting the seed that our people are in need. And if knowledge makes a man unfit to be a slave, then it's our job to go out and educate and fight to be the change. See, the most detrimental thing you can do in the fight for liberation is to isolate yourself from the problem. To not acknowledge and promote the need for community and joint efforts. See, I am Trayvon Martin, Eric Gardner, Parkland, Florida, the homeless vet, single mother, Sandra Bland, and Khalif Browder. Fighting like Miss Hamer, Ella Baker, Shirley Chisholm. See, I say their names and embody their stories because, truth be told, I am them. We have a call to defend the weak and the fatherless, uphold the cause of the poor and oppressed, to do just and right, and to deliver from the hands of the oppressor. And if I'm not mistaken, God has never called the qualified, but has always qualified the call. So my message for you, Joe, is to stop being average when you were born to be great. Mediocrity is not acceptable in the pursuit of excellence, so wake up and pick up, because our nation is depending on it. Sincerely, your sister in the fight for justice. Thank you.
For the poor of this society. They are living in tragic conditions because of the terrible economic injustices that keep them locked in.
We have to deal with our war economy and systemic racism and systemic poverty and ecological devastation. And finally, we have to deal with the moral narrative.
This wall, this is sin of the highest order.
We are traveling around this country building this Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. What we want to do now is hear a little bit from the local community who are a part of this campaign.
I've spent 5 years, five or so more years homeless.
Living on minimum wage has caused me to have to figure out on a daily basis how to afford basic necessities.
While the U.S. sends trillions abroad, my friends, family, and fellow veterans suffer the economic consequences of the war economy.
I have two children, and I enjoy raising them while acknowledging that being poor is a struggle of human rights.
But when I lost my housing, health care, and income all at the same time, I was terrified, panicked.
I want to stand here and reclaim the power and dignity of the mujeres in my life.
I can't afford to pay a cab.
It was one thing to know that you didn't have water and you couldn't afford your water.
it's a whole nother to find out that they shut off your entire community and none of you matter.
And in the aftermath of climate change disasters, poor people are, and people of color are the ones to lose their homes.
Who can survive with 725?
No parent in America should have to bury their pandemic for lack of medical expansion.
Being poor is not a sin. Poverty is a sin. Being homeless is not a sin. Homelessness is a sin.
And we are here. It is time for us to be the remnant that can transform the nation.
We are calling for a season of moral resistance, a season of organizing, a season of nonviolent, massive civil disobedience.
There will be a movement. Break through the con and cut through the lies and bring people together to save the heart and the soul of this democracy and this world.
Hold on just a little while longer. Hold on just a little while longer. Hold on just a little while longer. I know justice is coming. To pray on. just a little while longer.
Washington, D.C. And all over the nation, greeting family and Shiloh Baptists and all of the advocates and devotees of the Poor People's Campaign and National Call for Moral Revival, my dear loved friend and sister, co-chair, Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, my brother, Graylin, Reverend Graylin, and to Yara, our theomusicologist, to Reverend Erica and Clinton, and everybody that's had any part in us coming together tonight. I was headed to Washington a couple of weeks ago and contacted a bacterial infection with me if I would, years of almost being on the road every other week and just take some time and recover from that infection. Reminded me while I was dealing with this of how many people don't have health insurance and can't go, and how indeed our society, the very bloodstream of our society, has been infected and continues to be infected with racism and classism and militarism, and how we must be the cleansing antibiotic of this time and of this season. We're getting ready now to hear from persons who are impacted, and I want to say a little bit about why we must have a Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival. When a budget director on Ash Wednesday, as we saw last week, can go on TV, put a cross on his forehead, and talk about passing policies that will cut 7 million people from heat assistance and millions of people from Medicare expansion, and he's saying that to people who get free health care simply because they got elected to be senators and House members of the House of Representatives. And when literally we are a nation that said banks are too big to fail, so we give them cash bailouts, even though they're corporate crooks, but then we want to give poor people boxes of food, not even fresh food. We need a moral movement, a Poor People's Campaign, and a national call for moral revival. When leaders of both parties, whether Democrat or Republican, claim that they have reached a compromise on a budget, one side, the Republicans, say they've done right by the military. Another side, the Democrats, say they've done right by the middle class. And there are 148 million people that are either poor or working poor, and they don't even talk about how the budget impacts the poor. We need a moral movement, a Poor People's Campaign. When we are 53 years this year from the Voting Rights Act, and we have less voting rights today than we had 53 years ago after August 6, 1965, and when we can literally put up a map and show that the 23 to 25 states that have passed racialized voter suppression laws are the same states that have the highest levels of poverty and the highest need for health care and the greatest attack on our immigrant brothers and sisters and the greatest attacks on the LGBTQ community and the lowest wage jobs and the lowest density of unions. And when we see people who use racialized voter suppression like Trump and Ryan and others to get elected, but once they get elected, they then use their power to pass policies that hurt mostly white people and women and children because they make up the greatest amount of the poor. We need a moral movement. When DC still has no statehood, and thousands and thousands of people are having do not have representation, but they are being taxed every day, we need a moral movement. When we refuse to stop the sale of assault rifles, but we rush to cut health care and rush to ban DACA students, we need a poor people's campaign and a national call for a moral revival. When we allow greedy corporations to destroy the environment, and when you can buy unleaded gas but can't buy unleaded water, we need a moral revival and a poor people's campaign. When we have leaders that want to fund the war machine and fund a racist border wall, but then defund poverty programs and refuse to pay people a living wage and refuse to protect labor unions and try to kick out immigrants from this country with new rules that if the same rules were in place when their grandmothers from Europe and other places tried to come here, they wouldn't have been able to get in. We need a moral move. And all my brothers and sisters in the clergy, when we have preachers claiming to be representing God, and they're so loud when it comes to being against gay people, and so loud when it comes to being against abortion, and so loud when it comes to prayer in the school, and so loud when it comes to supporting tax cut welfare to the greedy at the tune of trillions of dollars, and then claiming that Trump, for instance, is the will of God, and then those same preachers say nothing about racism and poverty and stopping the sale of assault guns. We must have a movement that challenges it because it's nothing but modern day heresy and hypocrisy. And this must be a movement rooted in love, not in hate, a movement rooted in truth, not in lies. Because something is wrong in the hearts of people when they gain power and then use that power to inflict pain on other people. I pity them more than I hate them. When you can get power and then use power to hurt the poor and the least of these, there is a deep question before us. How much do you have to dehumanize yourself in order to dehumanize other people? Rabbi Heschel, the great Jewish prophet, told America in 1960, he sent a letter to John F. Kennedy at the time, a Democrat, and said to him, "You forfeit the right, this nation forfeits the right to even worship God when you're on the wrong side of justice." Howard Thurman once said, who was the dean at Howard School of Theology, he once said that we rupture the unity with God anytime we participate in racism and discrimination and attacks on the dispossessed. Just this week, Mary Wright Edelman, who led and helped write the policies for the original Poor People's Campaign, said to this to America, "When are we going to protect the children and not the guns?" So my friends, the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival, it's not about Democrat. It's not about saving a party. It's not about Democrats or Republican. It's about saving the soul of a nation. Because the real question before us right now in this third reconstruction is America even possible? It's about whether or not we believe in the deep moral principles found in Christianity and Islam and Judaism and so many other great religions. Those great principles that say a nation is judged by how they treat the least of these. The question before us is, do we believe and are we willing to stand in the great moral constitutional tradition that teaches us that the only freedom worth having is one that ensures domestic tranquility, establishes justice, provides for the common defense, and promotes the general welfare? And that's why the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival, is doing this. That's why we're called all over the country. This is not because this is the 50th anniversary of Poor People's Campaign and the assassination of Dr. King. Let me be very clear. First of all, you don't commemorate an assassination. You don't celebrate an assassination. If anything, you reach down in the blood and pick up the baton and carry it the rest of the way. But not only that. The original Poor People's Campaign was not just Dr. King, it was 25 other. There are people in that audience tonight. My dear sister from Maryland and others that made the march, that pushed, that became what Dr. King called that unsettling force, and they were thrown out of the shanty. 25 other organizations, national welfare rights workers, Jews and others came together. And it's unfinished work. We have an audit now. It was done by the IPS, Institute for Policy Studies, and the Urban Institute, and impacted people and scholars. And we've done it. It's called The Souls of Poor Folk, Auditing America 50 Years After. Hope you'll all go get it. It's online. And that audit clearly shows that systemic racism, systemic poverty, ecological devastation, war economy, and militarism, and the distorted national morality are five issues that must be dealt with together. You can't deal with them separately. They must be dealt with together, and they require a national moral revival and a revolution of values. That's why we're now organizing 1,000 people in 32 states. We need 2,000 in D.C. to engage in 40 days of direct action, necessary civil disobedience, voter mobilization, and power building among the poor, not to end a movement, but to launch a movement and to shift the narrative in this country. We had 26 presidential debates during the last election, and not 1 hour on racism and voter suppression, not 1 hour on poverty, not 1 hour on the negative impact of militarism. We must shift the narrative, because if the narrative is wrong, the agenda will be wrong. And this movement must be with the poor. Let me say that again, with the poor, not for the poor, not paternalistically, but with the poor. And clergy and moral leaders must join and conspicuously challenge in collars, in clothing, in whatever religious garb. We must conspicuously leave our pulpits and leave our sanctuary and turn the streets into our sanctuary and turn the steps of state capitals and the steps of the United States Capitol and the offices into sanctuary to challenge what is going on. And we must do it in our deepest nonviolent tradition. And so that's why tonight, after I speak, the first voices you will hear will be testified, impacted persons who will lead this movement, who we will stand with. We will put a face on the pain, because we need a political Pentecost in America. Oh yeah, I'm part Pentecost. We need black and white and brown and red and yellow and gay and straight and north and south and east and west, and Jews and Christians and Muslims and people who don't necessarily have a religious faith but believe in deep moral principles, and Unitarians. We need all of them coming together. Young people and old people, wealthy people who got enough sense to know that their wealth is a responsibility to fight for justice. Poor people who say, I'm not going to just allow people to step on me and not say anything. We need all of those coming together so we can speak with new tongues and act with new power. Last thing we can do is sit down and say nothing. As I close, Liz, somebody asked me one day, they said, where did you all come up with this idea of Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival? I said, well, three things. First of all, every age has to have moral dissenters. The abolitionists did it in their time. The women who fought for women's suffrage, they did it in their time. The bonus marches during the 1920s and when during the round of time that the stock markets crashed, they did it in their time. The social gospel movement did it in their time. The slave preachers did it in their time. The civil rights movement and SNCC and all others did it in their time. So we're just standing where history has always told us that we have to stand up. You cannot be quiet. You can't tweet some things away. You can't email some things away. You have to have a movement. And a movement where everybody can come together for a period of time that can actually benefit all of the movement. Because all of the movements we see happening are the birth pain. Even have children now talking about marching on D.C. in March over guns. Because it's time. But I want you to know, finally, this wisdom comes straight out of the Bible. The book of Amos. Many of us know that passage where it says, let justice roll down like waters, but righteousness like a mighty stream. But before you get to that passage, there's another passage, Amos chapter 5, verse 12, and it gives us some marching orders that are as old as the Bible, but as powerful as the present moment and the presence of the Spirit. Here they are, and I'll read it to you in the Message Bible, and I'm through tonight, because I want you to hear these testifiers, and I want you to hear Dr. Harris, and I want you to sign up tonight, D.C. We need 2,500 from D.C., to help us mobilize. But here it is, chapter 5 of Amos, verse 12 in the Message Bible. It says, listen, people hate truth kind of talk. Raw truth is never popular, but here it is. Here it is and what the nation needs to hear. Because you have run roughshod over the poor, because you take bread right out of the poor people's mouths, you're never going to move into your luxurious home that you've built. You're never going to drink wines from the expensive vineyards you have down at Mar-a-Lago. Excuse me, that's not there. That's just a little ad. It says, I know precisely the extent of your violation. America, I know the enormity of your sins. It's appalling. This is what's happening. You have politicians who bully right-living people. They take bribes right and left, and they kick the poor when they're down. To some people, it looks like justice is a lost cause, and evil is epidemic, and some decent people are throwing up their hands and just giving up, saying that protest and rebuke are useless. But I need some people, God says, who will seek good and not evil. I need some people who will choose to live and not die. You talk about the God of the angel army being your best friend, America, nation. Well, if God is your best friend, then the nation ought to live like it. And the only way the nation can prove that you truly honor God is to hate evil and love God. And then you've got to work it out in the public policies. You've got to work it out in public square. And if you do that, then God may see the nation and be gracious. Verse 16 says, so this is what God says. I need a remnant. If the nation is going to be saved, I need a remnant. I need a remnant that will go into the streets and cry loudly and lament over what is going on. I need a remnant that will fill the malls and the shops with the cries of doom. I need a remnant that will weep loudly and say, not me, not us, not now. We can't take it anymore. I need a remnant that will empty the offices, empty the stores, empty the factories, empty the workplaces, and enlist everybody in a general lament calling for national repentance. And God says in this final verse, I want to hear you cry so loud, because when I hear you cry, then God says, I'll come help you. Could it be that God can't really help us until we get in the streets, until we challenge the systems of injustice, until we cry and wail and mourn and make it clear that the poor and racism will not be ignored. But if we do that, if a remnant will do it, if 25,000 people will do it, if 25 states in the District of Columbia will do it, and if we'll stand together simultaneously, we can change the narrative in this country. We can invite divine assistance to help us, and we can refuse to give up on this democracy and this world. I tell you, it's time for a poor people's campaign and a national call for moral revival. God bless you and love you tonight.
We thank Reverend Dr. Barber for joining us from Goldsboro, North Carolina, and our best wishes and prayers are with him and this whole campaign as we go forward. At this point, I want to introduce someone who in D.C. needs really no introduction, Reverend Graylin Hegler, who is the tri-chair of the Poor People's Campaign D.C. Coordinating Committee, pastor of Plymouth Congregational Church, and the director of Faith Strategies. And so please welcome Reverend Garrett. Yeah.
I want to thank Dr. Liz, and I want to thank all of you for being here. And as we heard Reverend Dr. Barber lift up, was that the issue is that we're not fighting for, but we're fighting with. We're not marching for, but we're marching with. And so therefore, we're going to hear from these testifiers that are here to talk about their issues. But you know, these are not the only voices out there, but these are some of the voices out there. And we will continue to hear more and more of the voices that will educate us about why we need to keep this passion alive, why we need to be in the streets, and why we need to continue to lift up our challenge to authority to be converted and to understand what justice is all about. And so you're going to hear from Mark Charles, who's going to speak to us about systemic racism. And Mark Charles is the son of an American woman of Dutch heritage and a Navajo man. He speaks with insight into the complexities of American history regarding race, culture, and faith in order to help forge a path of healing and conciliation for the nation. And then we're also going to hear from Sister Anna Rodon, who is going to speak to us also of systematic racism in terms of immigration. She works with Many Languages, One Voice, and the Terrence Sterling Movement, Dreamers, and she continues on her personal advocacy to bring transformation to the community in all of her endeavors. And then we will also hear from Dana Pope, talking about poverty. As an activist who tries to connect the different groups she organizes with, because our struggles and our liberation are intertwined. She teaches workshops on conflict transformation, anti-oppression, and relationship building, and is a member of the Washington Ethical Society. We will also hear from Rhonda Hamilton on ecological devastation, and she is an advisory neighborhood commissioner and a president of Synapse Gardens Residential Council, a native Washingtonian, and have been advocating for her community because they are being exposed to environmental hazards in the places in which they live. And then we will hear from Brock McIntosh on the war economy. And Brock is an Afghanistan war veteran who served 8 years with the Army National Guard. He is a member of About Face, a veteran-led movement against militarism, a certified Kenyan nonviolent trainer, and an advocate for veteran health. We will hear from them as they come forward to lift up their concerns, their issues, and also to engage and embrace us in the work that they do.
Yat-e. First of all, just a side note, you should never give the mic first to a native. You have color people time, we have Navajo time, native time. You ain't seen nothing yet. Before we start, I want to just ask if there's anyone in the room here who is from the Piscataway or the Haudenosaunee tribes. Okay? I ask because it's the Piscataway who were ethnically cleansed from this land. They were the ones who lived here. They were the ones who hunted and fished here. They lived along the Potomac. And they, along with the Haudenosaunee, were the ones who were ethnically removed from this area so that the nation's capital could be built and so that white settlement could move in. And so I would just like everyone to give a round of applause for the Piscataway and the Haudenosaunee because of... It's important that we acknowledge the people who have stewarded this land. It's important that we acknowledge that these lands were not discovered. In my presentation here, which I will do my best to keep to 3 minutes, I want to help you understand what it feels like from a systemic racism standpoint to be Native in the United States, especially around the celebration of holidays. We'll start simple. Columbus Day. Okay? It's quite obvious to anyone that you cannot discover lands already inhabited. If you don't believe me, leave your cell phones, your car keys, your wallets out. I'll come by and discover them for you. Clearly, this is not discovery. This is stealing. This is colonizing. This is conquering. And yet we have a statue just a few miles away from here honoring Columbus as the discoverer of America. This is a problem for Native peoples. Second, another holiday. Well, you'll remember about 3 years ago, we had a dialogue about the appropriateness of the Confederate flag. It was actually taken off of a Capitol building by an activist. This was in the spring of 2015. And I watched this with great interest because this was a good conversation. We had to have this. We needed to discuss this. But then I was really intrigued because just a few weeks after this dialogue died down, everyone took the day off, they bought their hot dogs, they bought their fireworks, and they went out to celebrate another piece of systemic racism within our country, which is the Declaration of Independence. You may not know this, but 30 lines after the sentence, "All men are created equal," the Declaration of Independence refers to natives as merciless Indian savages. Making it very clear, the only reason our founding fathers used this inclusive term, "all men," it's because they had a very narrow definition of who was actually human. Now that brings us to today, President's Day, Abraham Lincoln's birthday. I'm going to say some history many of you may know. I know I will present some that none of you have never heard of before. In 1858, President Lincoln, in his first debate with Stephen Douglas, he said there was a physical difference between the white and the black man, which will never allow them to be on equal footing. I have no intention to make voters or jurors of Negroes, nor to allow them to vote, nor to allow them to intermarry with us. And as long as there must be a position of superior and inferior, I believe the race to which I belong will always be the superior race. President Lincoln said the same thing almost verbatim in the fourth debate with Stephen Douglas. In his inauguration, he said, "I have no intention to free the slaves, for slavery already exists. And if you want to know how I feel about the races and black people, go back and read what I've said before." And then he quoted himself from the first debate. In 1862, when Horace Greeley called for the immediate emancipation of the slaves, Abraham Lincoln said, "My primary objective in this struggle is not to save or destroy slavery. It is to preserve the Union. If I could save the Union without freeing a single slave, I would do it. If I could save by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. If I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that." That quote is hanging at the Lincoln Memorial, stating for anyone who comes in, according to Abraham Lincoln, black lives don't matter. Now, you all know that when he emancipated the slaves, he didn't free all of them. Now, what you may not know is that Abraham Lincoln used the pretext of the Civil War to further the campaigns against Indian people. December 26th of 1862, President Abraham Lincoln ordered the largest mass execution in the history of our nation with the hanging of the Dakota 38. In 1864, a U.S. Army under the command of Commander-in-Chief Abraham Lincoln came across Cheyenne and Arapaho men, women, and children, 200 of them encamped over a hillside in Colorado. They were waving a white flag of surrender and an American flag, and they ordered all of them slaughtered. It was later reported that the soldiers paraded their genitalia down the streets of Denver. In 1861, they stepped up their campaigns against the Navajo and the Pueblo in New Mexico. In August of 1863, a general of the U.S. Army gave this order to one of the soldiers. He said, "Henceforth, every Navajo male is to be killed or taken prisoner on sight. Say to them, go to the Bosque Redondo or we will pursue you and destroy you. We will not make peace with you or any other terms. This war shall be pursued until you cease to exist or move. There can be no talk on the subject." And then they rounded up over 8,000 Navajo men, women, and children and marched us down to Bosque Redondo in what is known as the Long Walk. I want to say this. As a Navajo man, I find many of the holidays celebrated by the United States of America lamentable. 4th of July, Columbus Day, Thanksgiving. But President's Day, the fact that as a nation we celebrate Abraham Lincoln's birthday and have whitewashed the exploits of a racist, genocidal, ethnic cleansing president like Abraham Lincoln is ethically, politically, socially, and morally reprehensible. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm not going to keep you here long. I don't know how to talk that pretty, but I got a message for you. My name is Ana Rondon. I'm from the Dominican Republic. I am a dreamer. My mother is the original dreamer. So I don't know how they want me to support for me to stay here for my mother to go. So I'm here on behalf of the immigrants. I'm asking for you to understand that anything out here that affects my family and the United States or in the world will affect all of us. Because we are one. We are one. God made us the way we are on purpose. We are unique. We are the beautiful garden that God made. And my message to all of you, I just want to tell you, for my immigrant who came from Dominican Republic and did not know that my color was a problem. My color was never a problem to me, but now it is, because I live in the United States. But I'm also a mother of 6 non-white children, and that worries me to death, because a gentleman of name Terrence Sterling was shot and killed because he was not white. And as a mom, that brings a big concern to me, because I know even though I make sure my kids get a white education, try to get an equal education for them, that might not help them at all, because the education is not helping us out here. So I want you to remember that black lives do matter. I'm nervous. I'm worried. I need for y'all to understand that I need all of y'all, every one of y'all, for me, my kids, my community, and everyone who lives in the world to survive. So just keep in mind, please, I might get you tired with this, but I need you to survive. Thank you, y'all.
I'm Dana Pope. Poverty is relative. When I was a kid, I didn't know how much money my parents or anyone else's parents made. All I knew was that my family seemed to have less stuff that other kids took for granted. I was made fun of by the other kids at church for only having one pair of church shoes that I wore every Sunday. I felt like I had to hide the fact, as best I could, that my clothes mostly came from yard sales and thrift stores. I saw how other kids who weren't as able to hide it or who came to school with a stain on their clothes were mercilessly teased and bullied. We never went hungry, but we often ate things like hot dogs, bologna sandwiches, and ramen noodles. Besides being cheap, my younger sister and I were able to prepare them for ourselves when our parents were working and we were alone. As an adult, my world has vastly expanded, and the impact of poverty on my life has become both more obvious and painful. I live with my husband in my in-laws' basement because we cannot afford to pay rent. We both make well below the poverty line. Many things that middle-class people take for granted are out of reach for us. We have tens of thousands of dollars in student loans and can't afford to pay enough to cover the interest each month. We don't have enough savings or income to cover most unexpected expenses. People at our congregation ask us where we're going on vacation in the summer, but that's not really something we can afford. We keep putting off having a baby because we don't have stable income, but considering I'm 37, our window is going to close soon. People in situations like mine and worse are constantly told by society that we aren't good enough, that there's something wrong with us, we aren't trying hard enough, and that we deserve what little we have and no more. All of this is false. The reality is that poverty is created by decisions that our society makes. Everyone deserves to have a place to live. No one should ever go hungry because there is enough food in the world to feed everyone. No one should ever go without medicine or other health care because they can't afford it. These are things that every member of my family has gone through. My brother has suffered the worst physically. He has been unable to work for years and was repeatedly denied disability and the Medicare that comes with it until recently. Because he couldn't get regular health care, he didn't have treatment for complications with diabetes until they had to amputate his lower leg to save his life. Now his kidneys are beginning to fail, and he is housing insecure and has been homeless for much of the last year. If he doesn't have stable housing and show that he can pay for certain transplant expenses, he can't be on the transplant list. He's been on the Section 8 housing waiting list for years, but now he's in a wheelchair because he isn't strong enough to use a prosthetic, and the list is long. So he might end up dying if we can't raise enough money to keep him in his apartment. The whole situation is terrible and preventable. I am here as the person to talk about the evils of poverty, but I don't actually believe in evil. Most of what people call evil is what happens when we humans get disconnected and stop seeing each other's full humanity. The same is true of poverty. We are taught that poverty is the fault of the individual, and we are encouraged to stigmatize and ostracize poor people. The reality is that poverty is largely a result of factors that we as individuals have little control over. Was I born to parents who have inherited wealth? Do I live in an area of the country where jobs have vanished because of automation? As a society, we have policies and institutions that create and reinforce poverty. But what we know here in the Poor People's Campaign is that if people made it, then we can change it. We can push for equitable distribution of resources so that these evils are eradicated once and for all. Thank you.
First, I'd like to give honor to my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. My heart was convicted the other day to a homeless man on a metro train. He was asking other people on the train for money. No one on that end of the train had money for him or offered him money. That really bothered the man, and he said in response that the poor will always be with you. And he turned to the lady on his left and said, maybe your life will be a little better if you help me. I quickly realized that the Lord was speaking to me through the man on the train. As I advocate for my community and for us to live in an environment that is free of hazards, I'm also begging and pleading for others to help us or for someone to simply care, just as the man on the train. I'm here today to speak up for my community. I'm here today to share our story. Many of us, like myself, live in public and subsidized housing in Southwest. And each day we face the health consequences of living near and beside cement plants in a highly contaminated massive brownfield site that reduces our life expectancies and makes it hard for us to breathe. This is not a story that you will hear on 11 o'clock news. And this is one story that some would prefer that I not share. But I'm here today to continue to break the silence and barriers of environmental pressure that have hurt my people. We are low to moderate income residents whose lives are being sacrificed to redevelop and construct a soccer stadium and to make way for the creation of high-end market rate housing complexes as our lives are being shattered. The residents near Buzzard Point wake up and have their breakfast with the smell of diesel fumes from hundreds of trucks and particulate matter that gets readily ingested into our lungs and vital organs that are hurting our bodies every day. We inhale this air with known carcinogenic particulates. This explains why we have high rates of asthma, respiratory ailments, heart disease, cancer, and a number of our residents are cancer survivors. When children and vulnerable residents, including ones near Buzzard Point, are purposely exposed to chemicals, poor air quality, and hazardous environmental waste, every person that hears their story should be motivated to take action against these injustices. It should be such a basic human right for us to live in a community and in this city that we helped to build and built up, free of these hazards. I'm hoping, like the man on the train, that you will hear this story and it will motivate you to want to help us. The power is in your hands.
I'm here to speak to you today about militarism. And as an Afghanistan war veteran, I wanted to highlight one of Dr. King's critique of militarism when he said, "This way of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into peoples normally humane cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love." And I'd like to tell you all today about the moment I realized there was poison in my veins. I'm the child of a nurse and a factory worker from the heartland of Illinois, a working class family. And when I was in high school at the height of the Iraq War, military recruiters, they had sign-up bonuses and college assistance that a lot of folks like myself saw as a way out. I saw it as a way up. I saw it as access to opportunities I wouldn't normally have. So when I was 18 years old, I joined the military. And 2 years later, I found myself standing over the body of a 16-year-old Afghan boy, not much younger than myself. This boy, he was a bomb maker. He was making a roadside bomb when it prematurely detonated, and his body was covered in shrapnel and burns. And he lay in front of me sedated because our medics had just amputated one of his hands. But on his other hand, I could see the callous roughness of a farmer or a shepherd. And because he was sedated, I could study the details and the humanity of his face, and I caught myself wanting him to live. This boy who is supposed to want to kill me, and I thought, if he had known me, he wouldn't want to kill me. And here I am, supposed to want to kill him, and feeling wrong because I want him to live. That's a poisoned mind. That's a militarized mind, and all the opportunities afforded me by the military cannot repay the cost that war takes on a person's soul. And it's always working class people that have to bear the burden of war. A working class boy from Illinois sent halfway around the world to kill a young farmer. So how do we get here? How does this war economy come to be? Well, first you have the demand. I see my wife there. Sorry, I got distracted. I wasn't expecting to see her today. But for a war economy, you need the demand, right? A society that is perpetually threatened, perpetually prepares for war, even in times of peace. And so you need a vast military-industrial complex and war economy whose charters and profits and stocks and jobs depend on permanent militarism and whose fortune prospers most in times of war. And the second thing you need is you need supply. So a volunteer military, they need volunteers. And how do you do that? You do that with opportunities. And that attracts working class people who need opportunities. And so we need a poor people's campaign to amplify the voices of regular people above the military-industrial lobby and demand jobs for working class people outside of war making. And to demand opportunities for working class people that don't require killing other working class people. We need a poor people's campaign to demand justice for people of color who are killed by a militarized police force. War always has a way of distracting us. It always has a way of perverting our priorities. And so we need a poor people's campaign to force our priorities to the forefront. And we need to organize for economic, racial, and ecological justice to force those issues to the front and rectify our nation's agenda. Thank you.
Let us give a thanks for our testifiers, reminding us of why we march and why we agitate, reminding us that who is us, that they are us and we are them. And as we go on, we're going to hear from the labor, D.C. Labor Chorus in just a second, but I want this to happen. If every clergy person that's in the room, spiritual leader that's in the room, could stand just so that we could see who is in the room and the kind of spiritual power that is here. Beautiful, powerful, and thank you.
Thank you. friends and your neighbors, the poets and the painters, socialists and the anarchists, pacifists and the humanists. Every culture and community takes black and white and brown. Times we won't see eye to eye, but we'll stand on common ground. Gonna take us all, make a change. Take us all, make a peace. Gonna take us all in the streets. Gonna take us all. Gonna take us all in the tank. Take us all to win the peace. Gonna take us all in the streets. Gonna take us all.
It is indeed going to take us all, so let's give it up for the DC Labor Chorus. Well, good evening. It's good to be with everybody. And we surely have our charge after hearing from those testifiers. When I was listening, a particular passage from the Bible came into my mind, from Jeremiah 6. And this passage has shown up a couple of times this week. Everybody's after the dishonest dollar. Little people and big people alike, prophets and priests, and everyone in between twist words and doctor truth. They dress the wounds of my people as though it was not serious. Peace, peace, they say, when there is no peace. My people are broken, shattered, and they put on band-aids, saying, it's not so bad, you'll be just fine. But things are not just fine. And do you suppose they are embarrassed over this outrage? No. They have no shame. They don't even know how to blush. There's no hope for them. They've hit bottom and there's no getting up. As far as I'm concerned, they're finished. God has spoken. But God has another word. God says, stand at the crossroads and look. Ask for the ancient paths. Ask where the good way is and walk in it. You will find rest for your souls. The Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, is walking the path. The ancient path, the good way, where we indeed together will find rest for our souls. But we must march now. This campaign has developed out of years of organizing, coming from poor people, dispossessed people all over this country. From the tens of thousands of families whose water has been shut off in Detroit, to people whose families member have died because of the lack of health care and Medicaid expansion in Vermont and Pennsylvania and North Carolina and Alabama, to the thousands of immigrants crying out for hugs, not walls, at the U.S.-Mexico border.
to families living in raw sewage, with tropical diseases springing up that had been eradicated decades before, reemerging in Lowndes County, Alabama, and all over the rural South, to the thousands and millions of peoples whose votes have been suppressed because of racist gerrymandering, to the attacks on homeless encampments in Washington State and Maryland and Oregon and Pennsylvania and Indiana and Washington, D.C. We have heard the cry of people that we want to be free, that we need a poor people's campaign, that we need a moral revival to make this country great for so many whom it has not yet been. There is a moral movement afoot in this land. A moral movement with poor people in the lead. And we know from history when those that are most impacted by injustice band together with moral leaders and clergy and activists and all people of conscience, that is when we can make a change. That is when our country gets better for everyone, not just for a select few. Consider the crisis that is wreaking havoc on our nation today. 43.5% of the American population is poor and low income. That's nearly half of this country. More than 50% of children are living in families that do not have enough food to feed them. 80% of us in this country at some point in our lives will not be able to make ends meet. We have fewer voting protections today than we did 52 years ago. And the United States spends $630 billion each year for the military, and only $183 billion for education, for jobs, for housing, for welfare, for healthcare, and other basic human needs. And do you know that pollution caused 9 million deaths last year? More deaths than any other cause. And did you know that 4 million American families today, just today, were exposed to unsafe drinking water? There is a crisis in our nation. There are storms raging and fires burning, destroying the lives and livelihoods of people all over this land. There is a concerted attack on immigrants with the revocation of DACA, the building of the law, increased deportation and detention. There are neo-Nazis marching on our streets and black and brown and poor bodies being murdered by police. There are church shootings and, again, school shootings and massive outbreaks of violence where we see that actually people are dehumanized. Life isn't seen as sacred. And actually, our elected officials are sending us a message that hate, not love, trumps everything in this land. There are tens of millions of people on the brink of losing their health care, and the tax cuts that passed are one of the largest transfers of wealth from the bottom to the top in human history. They say peace, peace, but there is no peace. And so we need a poor people's campaign. We need a national call for a moral revival. We need change. We need a season of moral direct action. We need grassroots organizing and voter registration and power building and building a moral movement here in DC and across this country. We need to shift the distorted moral narrative that is promoted by people all over this land, including and especially religious extremists that say that the issues of our day are not things like healthcare, are not problems like housing, are not issues like living wages, but they want us fighting each other and divided and blaming ourselves for the problems that we have and saying that there isn't enough to go around. But that doesn't have the last word. If we look at the sacred traditions of those that have come before us, we have hundreds and thousands of passages that speak to justice and love. Passages like, "Blessed are the poor, for theirs shall be the kingdom of God," or "No one can serve two masters, you cannot serve God and mammon," or "Sell everything you have and give it to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven." Or the story, as we have entered Lent, of a poor person entering Jerusalem on a mule train and saying to the people in power, when he goes and practices nonviolent civil disobedience, "Your ways are not the ways of something much more powerful than you." And so the people are getting together, and we're going to build a poor people's campaign. We're going to have a moral revival in this land, and we're going to break every chain of injustice, everything that keeps us down. We are calling for 40 days of moral direct action. We are calling for people in 25 to 30 states across this country to engage in coming together across every line that divides us and organizing for a better life. Months before Dr. King was killed, he got onto the radio airwaves and announced that he was building a poor people's campaign. And he said, when he got on those raves, "There is nothing wrong with a traffic law which says that you have to stop for a red light. But when a fire is raging, that fire truck goes right through that red light, and normal traffic had better get out of its way. Or when a man is bleeding to death, the ambulance goes right through those red lights at top speed. Today, there is a fire raging for the poor of this society. They are living in tragic conditions because of the terrible economic injustices that keep them locked in. Disinherited people all over the world are bleeding to death from deep social and economic wounds. They need brigades of ambulance drivers who will have to ignore the red lights of the present system until the emergency is solved. Massive civil disobedience is a strategy for social change, which is at least as forceful as an ambulance with its sirens on full." And so we're here this evening in Washington, D.C. We're gathered together with folks from Maryland and Virginia and D.C. to say, are you willing to sign up to be a brigade of ambulance drivers? Are you willing to ignore the red lights of racism, the red lights of xenophobia and sexism, the red lights of homophobia and the lack of health care, the red lights of the housing crisis in this nation, and the red lights of poverty and abuse and immorality? And will you be one in the numbers who will build the Poor People's Campaign, who will put yourself in the line of duty and say, I am going to band together with my neighbor. I am going to stand against systemic racism and poverty and ecological devastation and the war economy. And I will engage in 40 days of organizing, in 40 days of protesting, in 40 days of popular education and voter registration and voter mobilization and door-to-door knocking and getting involved in building a deep-rooted moral movement in this city and in this land. Because people all over this country are calling for this Poor People's Campaign. And so we are here in Washington, D.C. this evening to sign up ambulance drivers, to sign up people prepared to be a part of this campaign. And we are seeking to shift the narrative and to build the power of people from the ground up. This campaign will not change everything. We will not be able to win things overnight, but we know that if we get together, if we say enough is enough, if we say the wounds of our people are indeed serious and they need more than band-aids, that we know we can change this society and change the world. And so Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia of our nation's capital, are you willing to sign up, to be a part of this campaign? Because imagine this. On Mother's Day, May 13th, 2018, there will be people all over this city and all over this country in state capitals also lining up to be a part of this campaign. And so imagine this. When you hear, wait a minute, they're going into Louisiana's capital. Wait a minute. They're in Massachusetts' capital. Wait a minute, they're in Wisconsin's capital. And wait a minute, they're in D.C., in the Capitol Rotunda. And they're saying, ain't nobody gonna turn us around. Ain't nobody gonna turn us around. Because we're here to declare that we need a breakthrough. We need for human life to be lifted up, for health care to be available for all, for living wages to rule the land, for us to have an end to the xenophobia and racist policies that are running supreme right now. And we know that it's only when we come together that we can break every chain. So there are these cards. Perhaps you got one and you walked in. And at this point, what we want to do is for people to take out your card and to fill it out, to say, I'm willing to mobilize my community and be involved in this moral movement. I'm willing to talk to other people about a movement that is brewing in this country. I'm willing to be some of the thousands of people in Washington, D.C., who will stand together on Mother's Day and decide to risk arrest in the Capitol Rotunda, trying to fight for justice for everyone. I'm willing to be a part of a nonviolent, intergenerational army of the poor that is rising up all across this land. So please start to fill out your cards. Think about what you're willing to do. Think about who else you know that is willing to sign up and be a part of this campaign. Because what we know is that we need a movement. We are inspired by those who have come before us. We know that back in 1967 and 1968, Reverend Dr. King and Cesar Chavez and leaders of Native American communities and the Jewish Federation and the National Council of Churches and many other groupings said, we need a poor people's campaign. We need to start organizing ourselves. We need to go into the hospitals in Washington, D.C. until everyone is able to be served. We need to go to the housing and urban development offices and say, we need a real plan for affordable housing in this nation. And 50 years later, we need even more. Do you know that there are 60% more poor people in this country today than there were 50 years ago? Do you know that people are dying from these problems? So as you fill out your card and as you get ready to sing this amazing song that we've been closing our mass meetings out, think about how you are going to be involved. How you commit yourself to building a campaign.
Break every chain, break every chain.
We'll have people going down the center aisle picking up the cards as well.
Break every chain.
But if you're able, stand and join us in this song.
There's an army
Saturday, before the Supreme Court. Janus versus Tapsme. That is a bill to try to silence unions from being involved in things like civil rights, in things like human rights, even in things like voter registration. So on Saturday, 10 a.m., this Saturday coming, Freedom Plus, because we're going to break every chain. We're going to break every chain. Things are not won overnight, but they're won because we come together, stand together, and we refuse to allow ourselves to be separated. The union is our struggle. Immigrants are our struggle. Folks who want clean, decent water, they're our struggle. People who want to remain in the places in which they have raised their families, that is our struggle. We stand together tonight because we're going to break every chain.
So DC, make sure you turn out and make sure you turn up to what the Poor People's Campaign is up to. You can check us out at poorpeoplescampaign.org. You can text MORAL to 90975 to get regular updates. You can sign up with this card and be connected to the folks that are organizing in Maryland, in Virginia, in DC, in whatever state and city you're from. When Dr. King talked about the Poor People's Campaign back in 68, he said, there are millions of poor people living in this society. If they can be helped to take action together, they will do so with a freedom and a power that will be a new and unsettling force in our complacent national life. There is indeed a nonviolent army of the poor rising up in our country today. Please sign up to be involved. Please know that everyone is needed, that everyone can make a difference. And we are. As you leave this place this evening, make sure that you have greeted somebody you've never met before. Because this movement is about breaking down every barrier, every wall, and making new connections and a new movement. And make sure that as you also leave, you do so with peace and justice and freedom on your hearts and minds. Because indeed, we can break every chain. Thank you.